Before I introduce today's guest, I want to tell you about our sponsor of our podcast, The Great Courses Plus. This is the teaching company's The Great Courses, which I've been listening to for decades. They have thousands of professionally produced college courses or courses taught by college professors, the best in the country. And they've introduced a app for your phone. It's thegreatcoursesplus.com. And so you just touch the app and you open up the course you want to listen to. The one I just started this week is on Understanding the Old Testament by Professor Robert D. Miller II. So just to give you an idea of how it works, you just touch on the lecture you want to listen to. Like number one is the Old Testament as literature. Number two is the Genesis creation story. I'm right now on lecture three, What God Intended for Adam and Eve. Oh boy, this should be interesting. In any case, this is great because you can skip around. If I find one of the lectures boring, I just skip to the next one. You can do it on audio or video and all from your phone. It's a terrific way to consume content, particularly during social isolation. During the pandemic, it's a great way to become an autodidact. So if you want to know more, you can, if you sign up through my podcast, then you get a free trial. So go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/salon. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/salon, and you get a free trial with free access to the entire library of all these hundreds and hundreds of courses and thousands of lectures. So with that, I'll introduce my next guest. My guest today is Stuart Ritchie. His new book is called Science Fictions, subtitled How Fraud, Bias, Negligence, Hype, and Hype Undermine the Search for Truth. Stuart Ritchie is a faculty member at the Social, Genetic, and Developmental Psychiatry Center, King's College London. He's a noted supporter of the Open Science Movement, which aims to reform scientific practice and help scientists become more transparent in their reporting their results. So we go through the big four categories of the biggest problems of the replication crisis, that is fraud, bias, negligence, and hype. There's plenty of all of that. So we go through specific examples of that. And then we also talk about Matthew Walker's book on sleep and how that's been critically analyzed in terms of the sometimes overly simple conclusions that he drew from that. But to his credit, he's responded to some of those. Amy Cutter's Power Posture TED Talk and how that data was challenged. Andrew Wakefield's Vaccines and Autism, which was outright fraud. And that's probably the most destructive fraudulent science in history. We discuss the complications of determining causality in correlational studies in diet and nutrition. As many of you know, I'm interested in that subject personally, but it is a important topic. Phil Zimbardo's Stanford Prison Experiment, which wasn't really an experiment, but what can we learn from that? As well as Stanley Milgram shock experiments. Steve Gould's analysis of Morton's skulls that showed racial differences in skull size, therefore allegedly intellectual capability, and how that was then challenged, and how the skeptics of Gould themselves have skeptics. We talked about self-plagiarism, the file drawer problem, detecting fraud in science, terror management theory, which is most of you know I'm pretty skeptical of, but the larger issue there being to what extent priming research really taps into unconscious motives inside people's heads. Very difficult to get into that. So with that, I give you Stuart Ritchie. This is your host, Michael Shermer, and you're listening to Science Salon, a series of conversations with leading scientists, scholars, and thinkers about the most important issues of our time. Congratulations on the new book. Here, I listened to it on audio. Here we go. Science Fictions, How Fraud, Bias, Negligence, and Hype Undermine the Search for Truth. Great cover, by the way. I love that. And I also like that, my policy is book titles or subtitles. One of the two should tell the reader what the book is about. So your subtitle perfectly outlines the problem. There's fraud, there's bias, there's negligence, and there's hype, mainly media hype, but hype in general, that's part of the problem. So I thought I'd start today by saying, I think your book is really timely. I mean, it's super important that we clean house now and not just privately. Like, let's just keep this matter, you know, don't make this book public because, you know, then the creationists are going to find out or the climate deniers are going to find out and they're going to go, you see? But, you know, as long ago as the 1980s, when I first started writing about the creationist movement, you know, because they used to point out creationists, you know, all the errors and mistakes and biases on the part of evolutionary biologists over the last century, as if to say, you see, they can't get their story straight or they're wrong or they're biased. But Gould, Steve Gould would always point out, but it was the scientists who uncovered the fraud or the bias or the mistake, not the creationists. Creationists just sort of scrape through the journals to see if they can find errors that they can capitalize on. And that's sort of the point of your book is like, we need to do this ourselves.
Agreed. And, you know, when was the last time you heard an article getting retracted from a creation science journal because of some error in it? That's just not something that happens.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, then I thought I'd start off with where you start with the Daryl Bem experiment. Of course, I'm familiar with your attempt to replicate it, as well as Richard Wiseman's attempt as well. You know, when that study came out, this is an interesting problem because for, you know, decades, scientists have been saying, well, the reason we're skeptical of ESP and psychic power and all that psi is because you guys have no experimental evidence. There's no peer-reviewed controlled study, you know. So of course the believers came out, all right, Shermer, here it is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's by Daryl Bem, a famous scientist, published in a respected journal. It was peer-reviewed, it's statistically significant. Now what do you say? And I'm like,
yeah, it looks scary. It looks terrifying to a skeptic. It looks like it's a very legitimate thing. But then, of course, I think regardless of whether that result is true or not, it illustrates so many problems with the scientific method and the scientific system. Not necessarily the method, but the system that we're in and the way that we publish papers. So yeah, I mean, we can go through all the problems with that paper because
let's do that in just a second. But just a point that, you know, even though we say we're waiting for a statistically significant peer-reviewed study in a respectable journal, that isn't really what is going to do it. You got to have multiple and replicated and a convergence of evidence from different labs that all find the same thing and so on. And even that may not do it because I think you still ultimately need some kind of mechanism behind it. What would drive this process, say, if it's psychic powers in the neurons? And of course, you know, they have ideas about, you know, quantum physics and consciousness somehow, you know, we link up our thoughts or something like that. But we don't even need that because the study itself didn't show what it initially looked like. So let's just start there. What was the problem with this study?
Well, so there were 9 experiments in this study. So it was a really long paper with 9 separate experiments. And, you know, so the first one was the kind of eye-catching one that everyone found amusing because it had pornography in it, which is what got everyone really excited. So the participants were shown 2 curtains on the screen and they had to click one of them, whichever one they thought there was a picture behind. And they were like, well, I have no idea whether there's a picture behind. And they just said, you know, you just have to guess. If you just put a really boring picture behind one of them, like a picture of a chair or something like that, then they get it 50-50. Percent of the time, it's just a random choice. But if you put pornography behind one of the curtains, what Daryl Bem claimed in this paper was that people clicked it, I think, 53.1% of the time. So it was statistically significantly more likely than chance to click that particular curtain. And that was part of his argument that he thought that it was that this was evidence for some kind of unconscious kind of psychic erotic desire that we have to like anticipate erotic stimuli. And so that was one of the experiments. There were several others. And the idea was that you basically take normal psychology experiments that people would ordinarily be doing in the lab and then flip the timing around. So the one on memory, which is the one that we tried to replicate, was normally in a psychology experiment, maybe you would show people a list of words, then you would show them half those words again and then give them a memory test. And they would do better at remembering the words that they'd seen twice, right? I mean, that's just kind of obvious. But what he did with this really simple idea is he put the reminder after the test. So you'd see the words for the first time, then you do the test, the memory test, you just have to write down as many of the words as you can. And then you're reminded of half the words again afterwards. And what he claimed was that the people were better at remembering on the test the words that they were about to see afterwards than the ones that they'd only seen once. And so, as I say in the book, it's like you study for an exam, then you sit the exam, and then you study again afterwards. And that studying helps, like, somehow goes back in time and helps you do better on test. So this is like a mind-blowing result. And it was actually quite a big result in terms of like the statistical effect size. It was actually quite a big effect. So that's why we thought we would replicate that one. And we failed to replicate it. But I guess before we even get to that, the point is that there were lots of problems in the paper itself. The paper, you look across all those 9 experiments and there are lots of different sample sizes. Some of them have 50 participants, some of them have 100, some of them have 150. And it didn't look like it was planned beforehand. And you see this quite a lot in scientific papers. It kind of implies that the scientist was kind of collecting participants as they go along and maybe running the analysis, checking whether they got an interesting significant result. If they didn't get a significant result, they'd add a few more participants in and just try it again, and then try another few participants. A lot of scientists admit that that's exactly what they do in their day-to-day practice. There were also issues with the statistical tests that were used. There were very, very kind of permissive statistical tests. There were very kind of lenient statistical tests. And I think you would want to be in, if you were testing the existence of psychic powers, you would probably want to be quite conservative with your statistical test and only accept evidence to a really, really high standard. So there were those kind of issues with the study, which were pointed out at the time. And, this became part of a discussion about, this is the kind of stuff that gets published in the literature. And then, obviously it attracted a huge amount of attention because it was about psychic powers. But then we kind of thought, well, wait a minute, this is the standard way of publishing research. It's not that this is like abnormally bad psychology, psychology research. It's not abnormally bad statistics or experimental design. This is the norm. This is what people are doing in areas that are much less exciting than, whether people can sense porn in the future. Right. It's like, this is what people do in, clinical psychology research, cognitive psychology research, social psychology research. And so that kind of led to a wake-up call, even without our attempt to replicate it, which is a kind of a separate story and illustrates even more problems. But even just looking at the quality of this paper itself, there were enough issues with that would make you worry a little bit about the quality of science that's getting into the top journals.
Right. So this is not fraud or bias. It's just more of a built-in methodological problem with all of science, including, as you noted at the beginning of your book, that your replication was declined by the same journal because they only want original stuff, not replications. That in itself is a problem.
Yeah, we were told specifically by the editor that they wouldn't even consider sending our paper out for peer review, which, was our failed replication attempt, because the journal, whether positive or negative, is just not interested in replication attempts at all. I should say that since that happened, this was in about 2011-12, since that happened, that journal now, if you look at its website now, it has on its website, we would like to consider replication studies. So something has changed. I think that's still a rarity, but that particular journal, possibly because of this rather embarrassing situation that happened to them, in 2012-ish, and in fact, because of that, and because of the publicity that came around that, that was one of the things that started off this whole discussion of the replication crisis in psychology research. That was one of the things that really kicked off this whole kind of period of sort of soul searching that psychology research has been going into. And of course that soul searching has kind of bled out into lots of other fields of research as well. So, that's one, it was a depressing thing to happen, but actually there has been some progress in that particular journal, at least.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I closed my Scientific American column on the BEM study with a quote from, the psychologist James Alcock found in BEM's paper, writing the empirical journal article on his webpage, in which BEM instructs students, quote, "Think of your data set as a jewel. Your task is to cut and polish it, to select the facets to highlight, and to craft the best setting for it. Many experienced authors write the results section first."
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It's the worst thing you can give to students. It fits into this whole problem that scientists have noticed in the past little while, that scientists often write their studies as if they were stories, as if they were these nice, exciting narratives that they want to get across the reader, rather than the reality, which is often, sometimes results within one study contradict each other. Sometimes they contradict other papers. Sometimes it's a really messy picture, and you just kind of have to. I've been writing results sections and discussion sections where you just have to go, I have no idea why this result came out the way it did, because it just did. It just happened this way. Whereas we're you know, implicitly in some cases, and in the case of Daryl Bem's paper, explicitly encouraged to try and make it sound as if it was all a coherent story right from the start, that we'd planned all these analyses out. You know, right. you do these analyses, and then you write it up as if, you know, before you even collected any data, this was always your plan. And that's one of the big problems with, you know, the way that we read a lot of the literature. It's deceptive in that sense, in that you read a study as if it was a, you know, the technical term people talk about is a confirmatory study. It was there to confirm a theory or a hypothesis. But actually it was an exploratory study. It was just there to explore some data and check some stuff out. And it's totally fine to do exploratory studies and check some stuff out. That's great. But don't write it up as if you had planned them all along.
Yeah, you talk about the structure of scientific papers with their introduction and literature review, and then here was our hypothesis, and here's the methods we used to test it, and then here were the results, and here's our discussion analysis of it, as if that's how they had set out the whole process from the beginning, which is not at all the case. And but if you think about it, you know, the way science is conducted from the beginning, you're a graduate student, you get accepted into a grad program. You're affiliated with some lab, some professor, somebody who already has a research program going. And so you just kind of step into that and you start doing his methods. And so this idea that, well, I'm just laying out the facts to see where they go, and then I'm just going to follow these trends to see what we can, these exploratory trends to see what we can find, that's really not how it's done, because the professor that's your boss, he's already got a program laid out, and that's what you're going to do. Now, maybe by the time you're almost done, you can, for your dissertation, you branch off in some small little, twig from that main program, but it's not likely to be some kind of earth-shattering new paradigm you're going to innovate.
Absolutely. It's kind of a, and you can easily see in that scenario where the inertia can come in of scientists who kind of just get stuck into a mindset or a theory or some kind of theoretical position, or even a statistical method. You know, people use the statistical method that they're told to use for their data, even though it might be the completely incorrect statistical method, or it might have serious limitations. We've seen this quite a lot in psychological papers where, you know, there are these statistical methods that just don't, that are not the correct thing to be using, and yet they're used because often people are just told, well, this is what you should be doing. This is, you know, what your professor tells you to do. So, one of the examples I give in the book to illustrate this kind of inertia or this kind of theoretical inertia that comes in is the amyloid hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease, where, I mean, there is debate over this. It's not necessarily exactly as it was described by a lot of these people that I'm about to mention. But people who go against this idea, which is the idea that the amyloid beta plaques grow in people's brains and that is what causes Alzheimer's disease, people who have gone against that have kind of been bullied by people who hold to that theory, kind of had their papers trashed by the kind of establishment, because it's the kind of major main accepted theory in that area, and it does seem to have some serious flaws, and, you know, there are real problems with it. It may be that we've just never actually been able to properly test it because it would take very different kinds of studies, and studies that start much earlier in people's lives, you know, before the plaque starts to come in. So, you know, does it, the question is, does the plaque cause Alzheimer's disease, or is it just a kind of correlation? Is it just a kind of epiphenomenon of something else that's happening? People claim to have, if they've gone up against the kind of amyloid theory establishment, to have their papers trashed. And you can see how that would work in the scenario you described there. You know, you join someone's lab, they are a proponent of the amyloid hypothesis, and they're saying, well, we're doing research on essentially trying to prove this hypothesis. And you can see how it would be really awkward if you came up with data that kind of contradict their entire life's work or their theory that they believe, or data that that suggests an entirely different hypothesis.
Right. So even if you go out and you get your own professorship and you open your own lab and you start a new line of research, the barriers are still there at the journals, because the peer reviewers may be the guy you were working with or his colleagues that are promoting the amyloid hypothesis. Yeah, I thought that section in your book was really important, because this is a serious problem, Alzheimer's. And, you know, we baby boomers, we're starting to hit the wall now, and this is going to be a huge problem. You know, so I'm watching this closely, like, okay, come on, guys. We're getting up there.
That's the thing, is that particular disease, unlike cancer, where huge progress has been made in treating it, Cardiovascular disease, you know, there's been progress in the drugs that are you know, for those kind of illnesses. Basically, there's been no progress in drugs or treatments for Alzheimer's disease. We've really not made much progress at all. And so the question is, like, is it because we've been, you know, stuck to this amyloid theory, which might be completely wrong? Some people have made the case, and again, I'm not an expert in this area, so I don't want to make a pronouncement as to what I think is definitely the case in the literature. And again, it also might be that we just haven't actually tested it properly.
But the point is your discussion of that is that one reason why we may not have made any progress is because this is the wrong line of inquiry.
Yeah, precisely.
And I know Rudy Tanzi, who's the big Alzheimer's guy at Harvard Medical. He's friends with Deepak Chopra, and they kind of collaborate. Oh. Like, what can we do? Lifestyle, meditation, diet, you know, and so on to quell the attenuate the symptoms of Alzheimer's. But when you push him sort of off the record, you know, because he's got a whole list, like sleep and this kind of diet and exercise and so on and so on. It's like, but is there any evidence that any of those actually like attenuate plaque buildup? Well, not really. So what are we doing? I mean, should I do Sudoku puzzles? Is there any evidence for that? No. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. I'm not an expert in Alzheimer's, but one of the things I've done quite a bit of research into is kind of normal cognitive aging. So just the kind of standard, you know, decline in cognitive faculties that people experience as they get older that doesn't necessarily involve Alzheimer's, you know, that just kind of can happen non-pathologically. Often we have to just throw up our hands when people ask us, like, what are the things we can do? Because things like doing Sudokus, you know, taking part in intellectual activities are probably things that people have, you know, who are always smarter right from the start of their mm-hmm. life. They're the sort of things they do anyway. Right. So you see this correlation between like people who are aging well cognitively and doing Sudokus and stuff like that. But it's probably not a cause.
There was that study of the nuns that were long lived and cognitively high functioning at old age. Well, what did they do? Well, they prayed every day and they journaled and they, you know, they did cognitive games, and it's like, okay, that's what we're going to do. You have no idea if the causal arrow points the opposite direction.
Yeah. Huge selection effects and
so, well, but again, that's in the news these days between Trump and Biden. You know, they're both, you know, getting older, and they're cognitively, you know, you sort of hold your breath until they get to the end of the sentence or the thought. And in the case of Biden, he has a hard time finishing his thought, and Trump just ends up in some other place. And you do wonder, you know, what about cognitive functioning? So that's another important area of research. Well, before we get to the solutions to those, because that's the important part of your book, just hit some examples of some of the other simpler ones, like fraud. You know, why would a respected tenured professor, scientist just make up data?
Yeah, it's a great question, because you kind of think, well, you've got so much to lose. You know, these people, when you're discovered to have committed fraud, you lose your job, your papers all get retracted from the scientific literature, you're disgraced forever. It's such a terrible thing to have done. So, you know, the example that I open with in the book is the Dutch psychology professor Diederik Stapel, who made up, I think, he has had 58 papers retracted from the scientific literature. So he's a social psychologist, and they were all like snappy findings, like people who have more have messier desks are more racist, vegetarians are less selfish than meat eaters, you know, all this kind of stuff, which you can imagine, like the headline in the news right there, and it's easy to interpret and easy to sort of cite and so on. But nobody had bothered really trying to replicate those findings, and if they had, they would probably have found that they didn't work, because he made up data. He literally sat with an Excel spreadsheet and typed in the numbers into his spreadsheet, and then he gave those data to collaborators. He had this whole network of collaborators who had no idea that he was just giving them fake data. They thought he was really productive and he was running all these experiments, and actually he was just making it up from scratch. So he and lots of other people I mentioned in the book who made up their results, who faked their figures in you know, microscope photos and photoshopped in all these ways, which, you know, once you see it, it's really obvious. It's like, oh, that part of the picture is identical to this part of the picture. Why didn't I notice this? But the peer reviewers, you know, it can get, it just goes right past sometimes. So the question is why? Like, why are these people doing this? Well, I think, you know, we can discuss this more broadly, but I think the the scientific, the academic establishment or the academic system pushes people towards extreme productivity, right? You've got to keep coming up with these papers. You've got to keep coming up with novel results. You've got to keep coming up with exciting new findings. It's part of the same problem of the psychic research, where the new finding was the one that the journal seized on, and our replication, they just trashed it immediately. You've got to keep coming up with this stuff. And I think in most cases, this pushes scientists towards like low quality research. Like it pushes, it makes them have, you know, essentially haste instead of scrupulousness. But in the extreme case, I think when you have people who are really pushed to it and who are at the very, very extreme end of people who just like don't care about getting things wrong, they commit fraud. I also think they have a kind of weird relationship with the truth. I think a lot of these people actually believe in the finding. They believe that the research is true, that they're doing, that the finding is real, and they just think it needs an extra little push. They need to just like convince their colleagues with this really important new piece of data. That was certainly the case for another guy I mentioned in the book, Jan-Hendrik Schön, who's a German physicist who published dozens and dozens of papers in the top research journals, Nature, Science, loads of really good physics journals, and had them all retracted because they were all just made up. He just made up the results, never shared them with anyone else. But he seemed to, when he was asked, you know, he didn't just say, hands up, I made these data up. He said, sure, I made these data up, but it's real, but the finding is real. Right. So there's this kind of really strange relationship with what's true and what's needed to prove.
In a way, it's a little bit like when Uri Geller would get busted for doing a magic trick and people like Randy would say, you see, you're just doing that. Well, no. Yesterday I was doing it the psychic way, but it doesn't always work. So sometimes I have to cheat because you guys are putting the pressure on me to perform.
Right. Right. I think that's exactly the sort of theory. I mean, who knows, right? You can't take these people by their word in science, and maybe right. take them at their word. It's probably, you know, a lot of them probably are just kind of more psychopathic personalities that are just like wanting to try and take over the field. And one of the big problems is that there's very little deterrence for this. There's very little. You have a very low likelihood of getting caught if you fabricate research. So much of it just happens. You know, I have friends who are data sleuths or data detectives or whatever you want to call them, who kind of devote large portions of their time to discovering problems in articles, you know, looking at the data, finding, oh, that looks a little bit too good to be true. That looks way too good to be true. That's a finding that just could not be true. And yet it's published in the journal. It's been lying there for sometimes decades. And when you email the editor about it, they often really drag their feet about, you know, investigating, getting things done, because it causes a huge amount of trouble for them. It's embarrassing for them. So, you know, the consequences are often not really, you know, are often not really much. And it takes a huge push. You know, I tell the story in the book of Paolo Macchiarini, who is this surgeon who worked at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, which is one of the world's top universities. It's the place where the Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology is given out. So you get your call from Stockholm if you win the Nobel Prize. Like, they had a guy working for them who was writing fraudulent papers about his windpipe operations and killing patients in doing it. And it took them years, including after several investigations that made it really clear what was happening. They were massively recalcitrant in doing anything about it. So I think fraudsters, you know, can get away with it for a long time. And I think if you let people get away with things, they will do them.
Yeah, I had Daniel Kahneman speak for me at Caltech when he was touring for his Thinking Fast and Slow book. You mentioned this in your book. And it was funny because the replication crisis was just starting to take off then. It was kind of filtering into the media. Like there's some sort of problem with these priming experiments. Some of the other ones were like, if you hold a glass of warm water versus cold water, you're more likely to evaluate somebody in a warm, positive way. And like something like people at the top of an escalator give more money than people at the bottom of the escalator. You know, there's just dozens of these kind of cutesy, kitschy type psych experiments. Anyway, so Kahneman starts in on some of this and then he pauses and he says, assuming anyone actually did this research, and everybody's like, what?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are like sort of suspect that maybe some of the stuff isn't real. But that whole priming field is a really good example of a lot of these biases, not necessarily fraud. I mean, it's very hard to prove. And I don't think, you know, you would say, I don't think there's many cases in the world of kind of priming research that have been fraudulent in this kind of cutesy priming stuff that you mentioned.
Yeah.
By the way, my favorite example is one where people came into a room and there was a box in the middle of the room, a cardboard box, and they had to either sit in the box while they did a creativity test or sit beside the box. And the result in the paper was that people who were sitting outside of the box, if you see what I mean, had higher scores on the creativity test than the people inside. It's like, just can't possibly be true. It's obviously silly and obviously lame. Wrong. Something has gone wrong there.
Or measurement error, like the other one with if you prime subjects with words that remind them of old people and then you have them walk down the hallway, they walk slower. But that was just a measurement error.
Yeah, once you did it with infrared beams rather than experimenters sitting with stopwatches, once you did it with the infrared beams, the result disappeared.
Yeah, the other priming one, you didn't discuss this in your book, but I wrote about this in Heavens on Earth, my book on the search for immortality, because when I started researching this book, I ran into terror management theory. And terror management theory, I don't know how much you know about it, but it's all based on these priming experiments in which you prime subjects to think about mortality or their death or, you know, and so forth. And then they change their behavior, their evaluations. Judges allegedly give harsher sentences. And they have this whole thing about you want to enforce the kind of hierarchical worldview, a more conservative perspective, harsher punishments, all this to do allegedly with attenuating your anxiety about dying. So then they have this whole thing that starts with Ernst Becker's book about this kind of paradox of mortality, that we're the only species that knows we're going to die. And therefore, this creates this system of anxiety that we have to quell by doing things like being super productive and creative and art and music. And I'll just read a portion of this. It's a terror management theory invented by the psychologist Sheldon Solomon, Jeff Greenberg, and Tom Pazinski. And their big book on this is The Worm at the Core, The Role of Death in Life. So this was based on Ernst Becker's, and this whole idea that, according to TMT, awareness of one's mortality focuses the mind to produce positive emotions and creations to avoid the terror that comes from confronting one's death. So here's Solomon explaining it. Humans manage this terror by embracing cultural worldviews, beliefs about reality, shared with other group members to convey to each of us a sense that we are valuable individuals in a meaningful universe, and hence eligible for literal and or symbolic immortality. Accordingly, people are highly motivated, albeit quite unconsciously, to maintain faith in their cultural worldviews and a confidence in their self-worth, in other words, self-esteem, and threats to cherished beliefs and or self-esteem instigate defensive efforts to bolster their worldviews and self-esteem. So they go on and on about all of civilization is due to this terror management. And I wrote first, it's not obvious why contemplating death would lead people to experience terror and get defensive about cultural worldviews or feel the need to bolster self-esteem. It could just as well lead people to feel more sympathy for others who, after all, are in the same existential boat.
Sure.
Yeah. Second, why wouldn't such despair lead people to just give up on building or creating anything, since it's fruitless in the long run, if not the short? And then, of course, the whole thing depends on this unconscious state of mind. Well, how do you know that that's what they're afraid? I'm not afraid of death. How do you know this guy's afraid of? Well, because we primed him.
Yeah.
You know, so
then. Yeah, and then you've got those high quality experiments. Yeah, it seems to me like it's a theory that explains everything and thus probably doesn't explain much at all. Like, or you could invoke this to explain pretty much any empirical set of results or reality.
That's right. Well, so they have this whole thing about even in our hunter-gatherer ancestors, they were motivated by this death terror to do certain things. And so it's kind of an evolutionary just-so story. So I found, I'm looking for David Buss's analysis of this whole thing here. Let's see. Here is TMT is anchored in an outmoded evolutionary biology that stresses survival but ignores reproduction. It fails to delineate precisely how the hypothesized psychological mechanisms help humans solve actual adaptive problems of survival and reproduction, and instead focuses nearly exclusively inwardly on psychological protection. and it fails to consider why anxiety itself would have evolved, and it fails to account for known sex differences in social motivation, death rates, and causes of death rates. And then finally, it's like, in my mind, I'm priming these subjects to think about death. And so I construct in my head questions that I think will prime that, or keywords. How do you know that that's what's going on in their head?
Yeah.
So this is what my friend Frank Soloway, who wrote a book about Freud, and he says that the really tricky thing with theories like this is not what to do with statistical refutations, but rather what to do with supposed statistical confirmations. This problem previously arose in connection with psychoanalysis, and Hans Eisnick and others later wrote books showing that those zealous psychoanalytic devotees testing their psychoanalytic claims systematically failed to consider what other theories besides the one the researchers thought they were testing would also be confirmed by the same evidence. So in other words, even if all these priming experiments for terror management turn out to be replicated, how do you know that's what's actually going on inside the person's head?
Yeah. It's like the next step beyond all this replication stuff, because, replication is great, and it's been one of our major problems in psychology and lots of other fields too, including medicine and lots of other places. But if you're not doing the experiment right, if it's not actually testing a theory properly, if it's not actually giving us it's not well designed, then you can replicate all you want, but it won't actually get us any further in our understanding of the world.
Right.
I think my understanding is, in this case, the terror management stuff, I haven't read the paper, but I saw there was a kind of large scale replication attempt very recently where they'd failed to replicate lots of the terror management basic priming stuff.
Interesting.
I shouldn't speculate on it because I can't remember the details, but certainly I can send you the article.
By the way, I was at the TED conference when Amy Cuddy gave her power posture talk, and it, Stuart, this was the funniest thing. Afterwards, people are walking around with their shoulders back and their neck up, and they're like, "Oh, I'm power posing here."
I mean, it's a very convincing, and if you watch the talk, you think, "Wow, this is someone who's really, it would be the sort of thing that you would think there would be actual solid scientific research backing up." But in fact, there was I think this has been seen by 60 something million people. It's the second most watched TED talk of all time, the Amy Cuddy TED talk on power posing, and it's been seen by all those people, and it's based on 42 people. That was the experiment that she based it on, one experiment of 42 people. And there's been huge debate in the psychological literature, she's run a meta-analysis that apparently shows that priming works, and other people have run a meta-analysis that shows that, power posing, I should say, works. And other people have shown that actually that's massively flawed. And actually, again, it's one of these things where it doesn't necessarily test whether it's you've made some people sit up straight, and that's the effect that makes them feel more powerful, that makes them like change their hormones and all this sort of stuff. Or it's because the other people are slouched down, and that might actually be the thing that's having the effect. Like, it has a negative effect rather than power posing having a positive effect. So again, it's like, we can replicate this experiment forever, but the interpretation is not necessarily correct. But even with that, that original talk is a real and nice example of kind of research that's hyped up beyond the 42 people that it was done on. And actually, if you the lead author of that paper, so not Amy Cuddy, but Dana Carney, who's at Berkeley, I think, she wrote an amazing letter saying, I basically, more recently, so a few years ago, saying, I basically don't believe this anymore. The research that we did, the sample size was tiny. We kept running the statistics again until we found stuff. We didn't report all the statistical tests that we did. So we did loads of tests and just kind of reported the ones that were significant. We dropped some participants out of the experiment kind of willy-nilly without giving a real justification for why we did that. So she kind of said, I'm out of this. I don't want to believe this anymore. Amy Cuddy still very much accepts it, but even her original authors, the co-authors on that paper, are skeptical now of power posing.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, in the category of more dangerous ideas is the whole vaccine autism Wakefield thing. I think a lot of people are still under the impression that maybe he just made a few mistakes, or it was a complicated thing. He didn't mean to hurt anybody. No, you make it quite clear in the book, this was outright fraud. And yet he's still huge here in America.
Yeah. I mean, the investigative journalist, Brian Deer, went through he actually obtained the medical records of the 12 children that Wakefield had included in his study, where he'd claimed that the MMR vaccine, specifically the combined MMR vaccine, so not the three separate ones, but the combined one, was related to gut-related symptoms and also autism in these kids. Brian Deer found out that Wakefield had fabricated or deliberately altered, when he'd reported it in his paper, the medical history of every single one of the children. So you had some of the kids who had been showing symptoms of autism way before they got their MMR vaccine, some who it didn't happen until much, much later. But Wakefield claimed that in all or almost all of the cases, they had started their symptoms of autism, you know, withdrawing socially, getting repetitive traits and so on, just after they got their MMR vaccine. And so, I think a lot of people are like, well, some people just think it's a correlation causation error that, he maybe noticed that these kids had these problems after they got an MMR. And, you know, it was a mistake to make that leap. But that wasn't even the case. Like, if you drill down into the original data, that didn't even happen. The MMR then autism thing just didn't happen. And so and then there were all the kind of revelations of, it turned out that the lawyers that were paying for that study were there were lawyers for the parents, and Andrew Wakefield had some financial interest in the individual vaccines rather than the combined MMR one, so the individual mumps, measles, rubella vaccines. And so he would have, you know, if he would have profited massively if he had scared people off using the combined vaccine. So that not just was, you know, wasn't just a mistake, but it was a serious fraud, and probably of all the frauds that I talk about in the book and that have happened, you know, recently, probably the worst fraud of all time in terms of the effects it's had on the uptake of vaccines and the general, you know, vaccine skepticism movement. It existed obviously beforehand. I mean, people have always been irrationally scared of vaccines, but this gave it such a, I mean, I was going to say a shot in the arm, but, you know, no pun intended. It gave it such a, like, it gave it such a boost. And now, of course, it's had terrible effects all over the world. And I suspect, actually, we might see some echoes of it when the vaccine for COVID-19 appears. Sure. We might see some echoes of this, you know, vaccines, well, don't they cause autism? And you know,
they're already ramping this up about, you know, Bill Gates just wants to chip us all through these vaccines. I'm not going to get back. I'm going to practice my freedom. I'm going to go buy some guns. Okay, that'll do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gotten pretty crazy here with this. You know, we're not even there yet to have a vaccine, but there's people saying, I'm not doing it. And I did see a recent study that maybe the herd immunity doesn't need to be over 90%, which would be good, because I have a feeling there's going to be more than 10% people that refuse to get it.
My understanding is for measles, 90% is the herd immunity, but for COVID-19, it could be lower than that. And the vaccine, you know, if there are lots of people who are not interested in the vaccine, then maybe that would be okay. But
Well, here again is one of these areas where it's good that science cleans its own house, because there are people ready to pounce on any kind of mistakes that somebody makes in the direction that they want it to go.
Of course.
Yeah. The other one that I've always been troubled by is the whole diet, nutrition, heart disease, and so forth. You know, I've had Nina Teicholz on the podcast and Gary Tobbs. They've been challenging these, the food pyramid and all this claimed causal link between eating animal meat, fats, and dairy and so forth, and cholesterol, and then heart disease. And, you know, this turns out to be one of these really hard causal problems to solve. Yeah. It's much harder than, say, smoking and lung disease. And even that took decades to really to get confirmation and consensus on. This is still going on, you know, half a century after we got serious about studying it. So talk about what the difficulty is in the methodologies of drawing causality from those kinds of studies.
Well, a big problem in nutritional research is that people collect these big correlational data sets. So, they collect food frequency questionnaires, people fill in food diaries in these big samples of people. So, you know, maybe 10,000 people in this big cohort study give us information on basically what they remember they ate in the past couple of weeks. You know, they write down stuff. So already there's an issue there of people not only just failing to remember what they ate, but also giving us what they think we want to know. You know, you had 5 hamburgers last week, and maybe I'll just write that I had one. You know, there's kind of a social desirability bias there, as well as a memory bias of people just forgetting that they had an extra chocolate bar that day or whatever it is. So there's a problem there. But then scientists will, you know, run these analyses, and there's a lot of information collected on lots of different foods, people's health in lots of different ways, their vascular health, their amount of exercise they do, their psychological functioning, all these sorts of things. And so there's a huge amount of data just lying there, which you, in these big cohort studies, these big samples, that you can dredge through. And, you know, as I talk about in the book, if you run enough statistical tests, you will find something. You'll find something that's statistically significant just because of chance, just due to complete chance. And so this is absolutely ripe, you know, for this kind of data dredging analysis, mm-hmm. where you say, well, oh, look, it looks like, I don't know, whatever it is, drinking red wine is associated with this particular health outcome. Let's publish that. Rather than saying, you know, right from the very start, we're going to test one hypothesis and one hypothesis only. We're not going to get distracted by, you know, all these other things that we could test, but we're just going to test this one thing and then see if it works out. It's that people have, you know, a very kind of promiscuous set of hypotheses that is go in and just test loads of stuff. So that's one problem. And then, of course, even if the hypothesis was, you know, true and the statistics back it up and it's not just a fluke in the data and all that sort of stuff, this is correlational data, so you can't draw a causal conclusion from this kind of correlational data. There are ways you can try and get around it. People use natural experiments. People use their new kind of genetic methods now that you can try and use to exploit the random variability in our genomes that might actually be able to give us causal conclusions from correlational data, which is really interesting. The technique of Mendelian randomization, it's called, which is a new thing in epidemiology, but that's kind of very, very new. So the problem is that scientists often write up press releases as if the effect that they found, the correlation that they found, was actually a cause. So you right. should be doing this because we found that, you know, eating eggs is bad for your health in this way, or drinking milk is bad this way, or, you know, whatever it is. And then, you know, not only that, but then next week another person finds the result that completely contradicts that previous one. And so there's this great study of cookbooks where they looked through, you know, all the ingredients in a standard cookbook and then checked the literature to see whether they'd been associated with cancer in some way. And of course, loads of them had, some of them with really big effects on producing, you know, this is really bad, it causes cancer. Some, the same food, there's evidence in the literature that it's against it. And, you know, we'd expect there to be lots of variation in the literature, even if the effect was real. You expect there to be some studies that find it, some that don't, some that underestimate it, some that overestimate it. But I think a better explanation in this case is that people just, you know, dredge through these data sets and find any old thing. And so I think it's basically no wonder that people have really no idea what they should be eating, what the best recommendations are. for, you know, is red wine good or bad? Is alcohol good or bad? Keep seeing results that are going in opposite directions. And I think people just throw up their hands in that and just say, well, I'll just eat whatever I want, you know, because the nutritional research is just so, so poor.
Yeah, it is. It's I'm personally interested in it because I have heart disease in my family, so I exercise like a maniac. And I, you know, when I go to the Starbucks in the morning, I don't know if I should get the oatmeal or the egg sandwich.
Right, exactly. It's a fundamentally, like, you'd think by now we would have a really good handle on that. And people have suggested that we just need to just take a step back and just simplify things down and just do some large randomized controlled trials of you know, some of these obvious food group differences and so on. But as I show in the book, that's not easy either. The largest randomized controlled trial, or one of the best, highest quality ones, the PREDIMED trial, which was done in Spain on the Mediterranean diet, which seemed to show that the Mediterranean diet was positive and beneficial for mortality and heart disease. It had loads of statistical problems where they'd made errors, where they had failed to randomize people in the right ways, and they had, like, people who went to the same doctor all getting the same diet, which would have thrown the results off. And they've corrected them, and they still think the results show the same results. Although I think we should be somewhat more skeptical of it now that these big mistakes have been found in it. You know, the paper had to be retracted, and it was replaced by a new version. But I just think Even, you know, even a study like that, which had loads of funding, it was really well designed, it was all really nicely set up, even that had big problems with its randomization and so on. So, you know, this idea of we just need some very simple randomized trials to find the answer, it's a lot more difficult to do it. You know, you just get lost in this big thicket of the administration of randomized controlled trials.
Yeah, some of the other examples in your book that bothered me, I read Matthew Walker's book on sleep, Why We Sleep. Now, this is a field I know next to nothing about. I haven't really studied it. It's not something I pay attention to. And I love the book. I thought he was great. I watched him on Joe Rogan. You know, 10 million people watch this, like, okay, I'm going to get this amount of sleep and boom, boom, boom. And then I read in your book, like, oh, no, not all of this was replicated or...
Well, yeah, there was an amazing analysis done by who's a blogger, Alexei Guzzi, did this amazing analysis where he just went through the first chapter of that book and found loads of mistakes, misstatements, overinterpretations of research. You know, like again, like we talked about for the nutritional research, drawing causal claims from correlational data sets. And also an example where there seemed to be this, there was a graph that showed, I think it was... it was like where you get 5 hours of sleep, 6, 7, 8 hours of sleep, and your risk of being injured.
Right.
The risk of being injured with 5 hours of sleep was actually lower than it was for 6 hours of sleep. But he had cut that bar of the graph out before he put it in the book.
So and instead it's a U shape, he cuts off this part of the U, so it just goes like that.
It just looks like getting more sleep is better across the board, when actually that's not what the data showed. And you know, I think, as I say in the book, I think probably it is good to get lots of good sleep, that's like, but why overstate it? And why overstate it to the point of, you know, chopping up data like that and making it look, you know, more like your hypothesis? And I think it can only be because, you know, like we talked about right at the start, people want a nice clean story. That 5 hours of sleep being actually more beneficial in terms of it being injured is weird, and you have to kind of think about why that would be, and you have to think, is there other biases in the experiment, and you have to talk a lot more about, you know, why such a sort of counterintuitive, complicated result would be the case. So you have to actually, you know, give a bit more detail. But what he wanted for that book clearly was something simple and straightforward, so he has just the nice line. And I think that is, you know, not just a problem in popular books, but it's a problem in science in general, is this whole, like, as I said, you know, the warts and all approach of just explaining your data as they actually are. Is not what people want. People want a nice clean story.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, as an author of many nonfiction science books myself, I can tell you what the problem is in terms of book sales. I'd love to be Malcolm Gladwell. I'd love to, you know, just have that killer book that sells millions of copies. And he's a great writer. I love his books. But when I set out to write something like that, it never goes that way because it's so messy and there's so many complications and maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And my chapters, as I write them, they don't unfold in a beautiful narrative story like Malcolm's do. But I can't just like, well, I'm just going to kind of simple. I'm not accusing him of simplifying consciously. He's a great storyteller, and he gloms onto one study and then he connects it to this other study. And then he has a couple of anecdotes and he strings it all together in an incredible narrative. But it's almost never like that in the real world of how science operates. And so I think there's pressure maybe on Matthew Walker. Well, I have a contract to write a book about sleep. Okay. You know, what's the simplest straightforward message I can give? And if you wrote it like you wrote it with, you know, all the subtleties there, it's not going to come out with a clean message.
Yeah. Yeah. I suspect a book like that wouldn't have sold anything. You know, a book that really explains all the ins and outs and says, oh, we don't really know if this is the case. And this looks a bit dodgy. And let's look into the statistics of this study. Obviously, that's not going to sell as much as a book that says, you know, sleep, if you don't sleep, it will trash your immune system, you'll get cancer, you know, all the kind of stuff that the sort of statements that he was kind of focusing on. And again, I'm not saying that I think, you know, sleep is not a massively important thing. It's just that, you know, the data are complex, and they always are in every single scientific field. He has responded to some of those complaints. I don't think he's responded to the thing about the graph, cutting the bar off the graph, but he's responded to some of the other arguments, by the way, I should say, just to give him his
history there. Good.
But it's the case for lots of different books. I mentioned several other books. You know, educational books are a big thing as well, where psychologists who have done stuff on, you know, growth mindset, grit, these kind of educational fad things that come up Which, you know, in almost every case, there is a kernel of truth there, and there is actually a real result that would maybe be beneficial in some small degree if we rolled it out to, you know, lots of different schools. You know, like growth mindset training is essentially saying to kids, you can change your abilities if you work hard, if you don't give up. You can change the way your brain works, and you can basically become smarter in some sense. I totally accept that that's true. I totally believe that. It's just that I wouldn't write a book saying or heavily implying that it's the most important thing ever. Carol Dweck's book on mindset makes it sound as if it's this life-changing, amazing, wonderful thing, just like sleep is in the Matthew Walker book. But if you look into the details, the experiments are small. Some experiments don't show much of an effect. Maybe there's an effect there overall. Again, that's not the sort of message that sells books.
Right. Now, I encountered this in the medical literature when my mom got brain cancer. She had these meningioma tumors that they took out, and this went on and on for about 10 years. And she had 5 craniometries and 5 radiation treatments and so on. And so then we kind of sort of hit the wall. There was not much else to do. This is back in the 90s. So I started looking at not really the alternative literature. It was still mainstream scientific literature of experimental treatments you could do for different kinds of brain tumors. And when you actually read the papers, you know, they go, well, maybe this drug here might work. And you read the papers, like an N of 12, and 8 of them died. But 4 of them lived 2 months longer on average. It's like, that's what you're encouraging me to read? This is so depressing. And this is published.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's something, again, which comes up is this kind of spin that even if you get a result that doesn't look that good, you can often write your paper, the abstract, which is the bit that most people look at, of course, because it's a bit that's available for free. You can just write it up as if you found a significant, important, really exciting result. And that's what so many scientists do. And there's lots of evidence of, you know, people have scanned through the literature and, you know, specifically looking for this spin and finding that, you know, in a lot of cases, people are just blithely exaggerating their results.
Well, that's your hype section of your book.
Yeah.
It's like you read, you hear something on the news about like the rate of this particular cancer, you know, went up 100%. And you're like, oh my God. But when you read the paper, it's like one out of 100,000 get it. Now 2 out of 100,000.
Yeah,
like,
right. Exactly. Oh, exactly.
Okay.
The base rate of it. Yeah. But so you can give a very partial bit of the story, and then and it makes it hypes things up and probably helps you get your next grant, helps you get your next your next paper, helps you get your paper published in the journal in the first place. So, you know, you can see why scientists are doing it, because there's this huge pressure to keep coming up with papers, keep publishing stuff. And so you can see why they're hyping this stuff up. And also, you know, getting your papers covered in the media is really exciting for a lot of scientists. Getting a book contract to write about how your field of research is the most important thing, and you know, whether it's mindset or sleep or whatever it is a great thing. And so you can see there are all these incentives that are pushing scientists towards, you know, hyping things up, and also, by the way, making lots of mistakes and, you know, being far too hasty with the research and so on, and not towards the thing that we want science to be doing, which is, of course, just getting it right.
Yeah, that's right. Phil Zimbardo, Stanford prison experiment you discuss. I've followed that pretty closely. I know Phil, and I actually did a replication of this in part for Dateline NBC with Chris Hansen. And we ran 7 subjects through the exact same experiment. We had that we made up the box with the toggle switches. Oh no, I'm sorry. Not that. That's the Stanley Milgram shock experiment. Yeah, we did that. Yeah,
they were very closely related. I think they were in the same class.
But it's part of that kind of 60s, 70s guerrilla social science where, you know, we're going to try to figure out why the Nazis did what they did. Okay, so know, are we all Nazis, right? So we redid Milgram's experiment. The problem with redoing Zimbardo's experiment is you really ethically you couldn't get it approved anywhere. But it's not even really an experiment. It's really more just sort of a, I don't know, just an example of what people may or may not do. There's no control groups.
Yeah, it was kind of just a happening. Like it was just something that occurred that he and you know, the thing I mentioned in the book is that more recently some of the tapes have come out, like the transcripts of the tapes that were made at the time have come out that weren't known before. I mean, obviously this experiment was massively controversial right from the start, and controversial in its implications as well. This is the one where, you know, you get people in the basement of the Stanford prison, the basement of the Stanford psychology department, and turn it into a prison. And some people are made to be guards and some people are made to be prisoners, and the guards end up really badly abusing the prisoners. But of course the guards, it turns out, if you see the transcripts, the ones that are now available, the guards were being told by Philip Zimbardo basically what to do. He said, you know, you really need to hurt these guys. You need to really punish them if they do things wrong. You should tell them that they're not allowed to go to the bathroom, and, you know, all this kind of stuff, which they then, sure enough, went and did. And it was almost as if the guards were being told that they were doing an experiment on the prisoners, and that they were almost the Confederates in the experiment, which is just not. The word experiment is not something that should be used in that case. And so all the kind of implications of that, again, Philip Zimbardo has written a, you know, very popular book, The Lucifer Effect, on it. And, you know, that study is taught to every psychology undergraduate student in the world, I would imagine. That's one of the most important things.
Well, he himself said he gave them the mirrored sunglasses because he got that idea from that film, Cool Hand Luke, where the prison guard wore mirrored sunglasses. Right. Then he had a theory about this, that it you know, blinding the people to the eyes, there's no eye contact, and it dehumanizes each person. And then the bags over the head. Well, he said that they came up with this idea of putting bags over the prisoners' heads. And then he fast forwards to Abu Ghraib and shows, look, this is what they did. And I didn't coach anybody to do this. So part of his counter is that the Abu Ghraib is an example of bad barrels rotting bad good apples and making bad apples, is that this happens naturally anyway. So my Stanford prison, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, is validated by the real world.
It's like I think at best, it's kind of like a hypothesis generation activity. Like, I did this and I can now have these hypotheses about, you know, human behavior that we might try and test in some way. And obviously, as you said, ethically, it's very difficult to think about how you would test these things. But, you know, with enough kind of ingenuity, a psychologist could come up with experiments that would test the sort of hypotheses that would be generated by something in like the Stanford Prison Experiment. But of course, that never was the case. We're just given that particular occurrence, and then all the conclusions are drawn from that, rather than there being a big line of research. And I think that stands in for a lot of problems in psychology, where there's one not particularly good experiment that was done in the first place, and then everybody else goes off and does their own thing and cites that experiment, but never tries to replicate it or really check that the results there are really solid. And we go off and build all these, you know, large kind of edifices of research that are based on a really dodgy foundation.
Yeah, well, Milgram's research has been replicated, but it's back to this. How do you know that it's obedience to authority that is driving this? Because you're talking about what's going on inside somebody else's head, which we cannot know. So I create this word, obedience. That's what it is. It's obedience. Well, like in the replication we did at NBC, we have these people trying out for a reality television show called What a Pain. And they're there at the NBC studios, and there's executive producers walking around and camera crews. So our people they're not thinking, well, I have to obey the authority. They're thinking, well, I'm trying out for a TV show, and obviously they're not going to let me hurt somebody.
Yeah. They could see through it, but they were kind of playing along. And so the question that might also have applied to the original Milgram experiment, like, that at least some of them kind of thought, well, this isn't.
Yeah. I'm at Yale University. I mean,
I'm playing along here.
Yeah.
So it's another example of, like, how do you interpret the results, even if they are replicable?
Yeah, but I mean, like, in the attempts to explain why Germans became Nazis and how you get these you know, normal people in a matter of a year or so to kill Jews in an open pit or whatever, you know, obedience to authority is just way too simple of an explanation. There's just so many other factors going along there, and you know, they got a lot of them got shit faced afterwards, you know, so they drank a lot. You know, there were sometimes there were pressure to do it or else, but other times there weren't. So you're going along with it. There was a lot of anti-Semitism, you know, so in other words, human behavior is so multi-causal, multi-factor. And maybe we're overdetermining it in a way, but then the way science is structured, well, I got to test one hypothesis. So I'm going to control for all the other variables, and I'm just interested in this one. Okay.
You can see how this happens a lot, is psychologists will have their one thing that they think is really important, and they will then apply it to every, you know, societal, you know, place that it could possibly be taken to. And you know, it's the case in these educational things that I mentioned, you know, mindset and so on. It's made to sound as if that is the one thing that if you do it right, your kid will excel at school, no problem at all. But we know that kids learning at school is going to be associated with a huge bunch of factors, right? Social things, just things about their own levels of ability, their teacher, their general, you know, the state of their, you know, how their school is and its level of funding and all. I mean, endless stuff, not just one factor. So, yeah, these one factor theories are just, you know.
It's like colleges and universities in part justifying their huge tuitions by saying, well, you'll make more money if you get a bachelor's degree. And if you get a graduate degree, you'll make even more money. It's like as if that's the single cause, you know, this said, well, maybe your parents sent you to college and they're more intelligent or they read more, or they have more books in the house, or maybe they gave you a different cultural background, or, you know, it's maybe it's partly genetic. And, you know, there are 20 different variables that could explain this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a, I think when people do kind of publicity stuff like that, they lower the standards of the evidence they need to accept. And the problem is, and again, this is something that's, you know, that we've discussed several times, is that a lot of scientists are, when they're talking about, when they're putting the results out into the world, they're engaged in publicity. They're not engaged in, they're not really engaged in doing science. They're engaged in trying to publicize things. And so why make it more complicated than it needs to be? Let's just talk about one thing. Let's just talk about how sleep will, you know, is the real thing that will, you know, solve all these problems, getting people their 8 hours of sleep, rather than saying, well, you know, if you could build, if you had in your head, like the diagram of all the different things that that lead to someone living longer or being healthier or whatever, it would look enormously complex and sleep would just be in one little corner of that. And it would have a little arrow going out to lots of other things, you know, actually really important. And if you did an experiment, sleep deprivation, I'm sure people would, you know, would end up much worse off. But it would just be one part of that huge, big tapestry.
Yeah. I just read Judea Pearl's book called The Book of Why, about his research in understanding causality and how people that are steeped in that kind of research methodology, statistics, and determining causality from correlation and so on, it is so complicated and so messy. And there's not that much consensus, even among the people that specialize in understanding how to interpret causality from causation, from correlation. You know, they're not in that much agreement. And they have all these statistical models and diagrams with arrows going all over the place. And it's like, this is really messy.
Yeah, the world of, you know, even if you look at something like epidemiology, where you'd think one of the main questions that you learn straight off the bat is like, how do you show that something causes something else? The arguments are absolutely crazy. And not just epidemiology, but, you know, economics is another subject where, you know, working out the causes is sort of a massively important thing. And so they have all these instrumental variable strategies where they're like, there's been some variation in the oil price that might have caused this variation, and then we're going to use this as an instrument to do this. And you know, there's a lot of really good mathematics going on there. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of really exciting, you know, new ways to analyze data to actually kind of almost magic a causal interpretation from correlational data if you get the right data set up.
Right.
But a lot of it, if you kind of push back, a lot of it really is based on almost a kind of verbal argument that, you know, that this, the only way that the oil prices would have affected, you know, education or whatever is the way that I can think of, and not any other way that might have, you know, like a kind of a backdoor that might have been a kind of confounding effect in this analysis. So there are all these really interesting strategies that economists are using. And I mentioned earlier the genetic strategy that, now you can use the Mendelian randomization to try and use variation in the genome to say whether alcohol causes cardiovascular disease or something like that, whatever it happens to be. But a lot of these are kind of in their infancy, and I guess they're going to be subject to exactly the same sort of problems as the other analyses I'm talking about, that once people, you know, are able to do them at the push of a button, they'll just be doing them all over the place. They'll just be running these analyses with every single variable and publishing a lot of low quality stuff.
I loved your discussion about smoking and lung cancer. And in part, in retrospect, we look back at that and think, well, it took so long to determine causality because of the ideological bias of the tobacco companies who were paying these scientists to find this certain results that they wanted, or they were planting the seed of doubt, as in, you know, the jury is not in, the science is still not determined, there's no consensus yet. And, you know, they started all those trends that climate deniers kind of picked up on. But then you showed that, in fact, some of the arguments, like, well, there might be a gene for smoking or a gene for having tobacco smoke cause cancer, because some people smoked their whole lives and they lived to 100. How do you explain that? And then you talked about, I think it was the study in 2015 of a gene that does affect whether or not tobacco smoke can cause cancer in your lungs. And I thought, oh, wow, okay. So even that seemingly simple causal inference there is not that simple.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, genetics in particular has been, as you know, has massively moved on in the last few years. We're getting all these new techniques, and things are becoming much more complex. And even things which, you know, just a couple of years ago, we're really excited about, you know, polygenic scores predicting people's behaviors and so on. And, you know, the in the last couple of years, maybe slightly longer, but, you know, in the last little while, there are all these extra complications of different population stratification and people living in different places that might mean that their genetics are kind of confounded in some way, or that they pattern in different ways that might confound the analysis. And so, yeah, loads of stuff from genetics. It's kind of moving on at such a pace, and extra complexity is being added in all the time. But I think, you know, the smoking and lung cancer case is a really good one because it illustrates the need for triangulation. And that's something which, you know, one could almost write a whole new book about. But the idea there is that instead of just replicating the same result over and over again using the same methods, you bring in lots of different types of study that are based on entirely different foundations. So if you're worried about the genetic stuff, then you can bring in other research. You can bring in, you know, in the smoking lung cancer case, you can bring in, they ran studies on rats where they like put cigarette tar and on them, and it caused cancer to grow at a higher rate. There's epidemiological studies of smokers, but there's also studies using kind of natural experiments, and it all kind of triangulates. It all comes together, all hangs together, pointing towards the fact that smoking causes lung cancer, and not the fact that and not this idea that you can only do it with an experiment. You just need to do a randomized controlled trial, and you need to force people to smoke and people to not. That's never going to happen. Right. But if you triangulate the research, and this can occur across lots of different fields, you can make much better progress. So I think that's almost like the next step beyond the stuff I'm talking in the book is like, mm-hmm. once we've got our handle on that we can actually trust each of the individual findings, that the findings are real and they're not biased or fraudulent or whatever, then we can start to triangulate across different fields and really make proper scientific progress.
Yeah. Let's talk about the end of your book then, since we're over an hour here now, about mm-hmm. what the solutions to all this is. Obviously, we're not going to abandon science. It's the best tool we have for understanding causality. You're not a postmodernist yep. saying that this is all socially constructed and there is no reality. So, just walk us through the half dozen most important things we could do to correct some of these problems.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, the reason I wrote this book is that science is super important, and we need it. It's really precious, and we need to get it right. It's one of the most important things, probably the best thing we've ever invented as the human species. Getting it right is super important. So I think some of the major changes need to be made at the level of universities. So universities need to start thinking not in terms of who's got the longest CV, who's got the papers in the top journals, who's got the most exciting looking results, but rather think about which scientists are the ones that are contributing to this more kind of open culture, which scientists are the ones that are putting their data online and sharing it with the community, that are coming up with new tools to analyze stuff, that are publishing replication studies of other people's work, that are generally being kind of good scientific citizens in the sense that they are contributing to the thing rather than just building up their own CV and building up their own lab's, you know, reputation. So I think universities can like reward, and in the US, you know, you have the whole tenure system where mm-hmm. you give a tenure to people, and tenure committees are to a great extent looking for people with long CVs and lots of exciting papers published in journals, in high impact journals, that is, you know, the most prestigious, glamorous journals. So we need to kind of do away with this culture, or at least lessen that culture of kind of neophilia, this kind of obsession with new exciting stuff, and have more of an emphasis on, let's just make sure that finding is true. Is that really correct? So that's one thing. And the same can be said for research funders. So people who, you know, these charities and government bodies and so on that fund research can fund research not that's just the flashiest, most exciting stuff, but can actually, you know, push towards solid, replicable research. Scientists themselves can be more open and transparent. At the moment, if you email a scientist and say, "Can you send me your paper?" they're delighted. If you email them and say, "Can you send me your data?" They're a bit more reluctant. Mm. In fact, you might never get a response. And in fact, this has been done in experiments. People have actually sent out, you know, experimental emails to scientists saying, you know, to a whole range of scientists saying, can you send your data? And, you know, they get such a low response rate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, really quite depressing. And that's, you know, that might be because scientists are, it's not because they're hiding anything or they think the data are fraudulent or wrong. It's often because the data are a complete mess and they would have to spend a couple of days like tidying them all up before anyone could interpret what was in there. So that's all really important. The journals that they're publishing in can change as well. So one of the changes I describe in the book is that there are some journals, this is an idea that originated in clinical trials, that are forcing scientists to register their results before they write anything. Mm-hmm. So instead of this idea that you get the data and you just dredge through it and find any old thing and then publish it, you got to write down what you're going to do first. So clinical trials have been required to at least do some kind of minimal registration of what the overall aim of their paper is. Since about 2000, 2004, that kind of period was when it was starting to kind of kick off. Nowadays in psychology, this is much more common. And psychology journals have actually, so the journal Cortex, which is a kind of neuropsychology journal, has instituted this really cool strategy where it's called registered report, where instead of submitting your whole experiment, you just submit your introduction and your method section. So you submit your plan, basically, and it gets peer reviewed. Mm. And then the journal decides, the journal says, okay, we agree that this is a good experiment. The peer reviewers, you know, have given you some advice on how to do it. And they all agree that if this experiment were to be done, that it would be published. So you get your, the journal gives its permission that says, this will be published no matter what results come out. If it's negative, if it's positive, if it's weirdly uninterpretable, we will still publish the paper. And that kills this idea of publication bias, mm-hmm. where scientists are like publishing only the positive research and not the negative research. It kills it stone dead. It's such a great idea. It also, you know, there's lots of other problems that it deals with just in one go. So I think journals can change not just the kind of research that they accept. So they should be more open to replication studies, but they should also be changing the kind of publication kind of strategy that they have and have much more of scientists registering results and registering analyses before they do them. And that's not to say that they can do lots of exploration, that they shouldn't be able to explore stuff. It's just that you have to say that. It's just that you should say that in the paper. Here are the hypotheses we planned beforehand. Here's our tests of them, 1, 2, 3. And here's the hypotheses that we came up with kind of ad hoc as we were going through the data. That's totally fine. But the reader should know that those were the ones that you came up with ad hoc because they might be a bit less likely to be true. And that's totally fine. But you should just be honest and transparent about it. So this whole open science movement, which, you know, can take into account universities, journals, scientists themselves, funders, is just at base. Just tell the truth. Just be transparent. Tell the truth. And and I think that will solve a lot of the problems. It's easier said than done in terms of actually getting there, of course.
Yeah, I get asked to review peer review some papers periodically. I usually don't have the time, and it always makes me think, well, if I was a big name scientist in some field and I have a lab and I'm super busy and I got grad students and then I got a family at home and so on, and then the journal sends me some article, I feel I should do it. But, you know, I'm going to give this 10 minutes or, you know, an hour or something like that.
Exactly. And so you often find that, you know, big name PIs will give these tasks to their grad students, for instance, and which is, you know, part of the training in some respect, but it's also sometimes abused in the case that, you know, you just get your PhD student to do all the reviewing. And of course, you're never trained in how to review articles. Right. No one ever tells you what to do. You're just given the article and told, you know, write a review on it. So I think, some sort of more formal training there. And I think part of this whole open science movement thing, which we're kind of going through in science now, is making these things, making people more aware of these problems. So that one about, you know, peer review being, everyone being in a rush and, you know, what can we do about that? What's the best outcome? What's the best solution to that? And just making people aware of the problems in general, I think, and that's probably partly the reason for writing this book is to cause more of this debate and to have more of this discussion. I think the fear of being the next, you know, disastrous replication failure or, you know, someone finding a typo that ruins all the results in your experiment, I think that should be part, at least, of the motivation to get the
grant. If I don't find the errors in my research, these other guys over here that now do someone this for a living, they're going to figure it out. Yeah,
exactly.
and I don't want to be on that list. You have the list of the retraction list. And, you know, like there's the top 10 people on the list. I don't want to be on that list.
Yeah, the Retraction Watch leaderboard. It's like the, I think I say in the book, it's like the reverse Nobel Prize. It's like the people who have had the most papers retracted for, and in all the top 10 cases, it's fraud. I mean, obviously, retractions don't always indicate fraud. It could just be a mistake you made, or some sort of other issue. But and a lot of scientists now are saying, honestly, putting their hands up and saying, look, I made a mistake, retract the paper. In those cases where it's like 50, 60, 100 papers retracted, it's fraud.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be right on that list.
Yeah. I like your discussion of how can you tell if somebody has fraudulently, faked their data? And it's usually that because it goes in one direction. Whereas, if it's just messy, the errors are going to be kind of scattershot all over the place. And this reminded me of David Irving, the British Holocaust denier. In his trial, he sued Deborah Lipstadt for calling him a Holocaust denier. Okay. And in England, the burden was on her to prove that she didn't libel him and reverse it the way it is in America. And so, she hired a team of crack, World War II historians or historians of the Second World War, Richard Evans in particular. And so he went through everything he and his graduate students or whoever, went through everything David Irving ever wrote, checked every footnote and so on. Now, if you did that with anybody, you're going to find errors. But what they found was every error goes in this one direction of kind of exonerating the Nazis. Hitler didn't know, and so on and so on. Whereas, you do this to somebody else, it's going to be the errors are all over the place. And that's kind of what happened, I think, with David Baltimore. Remember that case where, he was the HIV/AIDS researcher in the 80s, and he got accused of fraud, and a big investigation ended up exonerating him, showing that all labs that do biomedical research, it's very complicated, it's messy, the data sets are all over the place, and if you really pick through anybody's data set, you're going to find errors, and his errors were just kind of scattershot in no direction, so he ended up being exonerated.
Well, I think it doesn't necessarily even show fraud if the errors all go in one direction. It can just be bias as well.
That's right.
So there's the stat check thing that I talk about in my book, which is this algorithm where it goes through papers and just checks whether the statistics are correct or not. So there's certain statistics that are based that are like if you've written down two numbers, the third one kind of has to be one particular number, and if it's something else, then you've made a mistake, because they're kind of dependent on each other. And so what they found is, it's some terrifying amounts of errors in the psychological literature, again, in some of the top journals in psychology, really scary amounts of errors, and some, a substantial minority of them were that the error would have flipped around the results of the paper, and it would have actually got the opposite conclusion than it got. Number of cases. But what they found was that the errors were not random. The errors tended, where there were errors made, they tended to make the results look more significant, more statistically significant, more in favor of the author's hypothesis. And so that's probably some kind of mechanism whereby the authors are, if you get a result that isn't significant for your theory, you'll just go and check, and you'll just go and have a little extra look at that and just make sure that's right. Whereas, And that's where you discover that it was actually a mistake. Whereas if it's in favor of your theory, let it by, no problem. That's great. We'll write that one up, that can be completely unconscious, but it just shows, scientists are human just like anyone else, and they're making these mistakes. It's just, we need better mechanisms to catch them.
Yeah. And they have egos. They like status and recognition like anybody else in any other field. And so your point is that the system is set up in a way to drive scientists in these directions of not just fraud, but bias, unconscious bias or whatever. They're trying to do the right thing, but the whole system is set up to push them in this direction if they want to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And the system of promotion, I mentioned tenure, just getting papers published and so on. That's why you find scientists are sort of obsessed with not just finding things out about the world, which is what you'd think and what a lot of them say they got into the job for. But they become obsessed with publishing papers. Where's your next paper, your next journal article? And then it gets to kind of some of the absurd stories that I have in the book of people, it's salami slicing. So, you do an experiment and then you write it up in five papers instead of one to make it, to just make it go a little bit further, like dilute each paper down, make it go a little bit further. Cases where people are so obsessed with getting cited, because of course that looks good on your CV as well, if you can say, I've this paper's been cited 500 times, that in the real extreme cases they form citation rings with other scientists and promise that they will always cite five papers from, cite five papers from me, I'll cite five papers from you in my next paper. And they form these kind of cartels where they all cite each other. Entire journals have been, loads of papers retracted, entire issues retracted because they were discovered that the journal editor was, involved in some kind of citation cartel where they were trying to boost the prestige of their journal by this other editor will make sure that he cites your journal an awful lot. And a huge amount of that comes down to, this obsession with kind of metrics we have. So we have personal metrics like the H index, which is like, how many articles do you have that were cited this number of times? And for journals, the impact factor, which is the average number of citations that an article published in the last 2 years in the journal, an article published in the journal would get in the last 2 years. And we just look at those numbers, and those were supposed to be numbers. I mean, the impact factor was supposed to be a number that helped librarians choose which journals to subscribe to because they've got limited resources and so on. But it's become like the number that tells you the prestige and the quality of the journal, which is never what it was intended to do. But we know, as you say, everyone's busy. Everyone's, got loads of other stuff to do. And so they use these as heuristics, these numbers, and they become obsessed with getting into Nature, which has an impact factor of 44 or whatever it was when I last looked, and not so much other journals which have maybe an impact factor of something like one or something like that. So there are big problems with using these as averages because they're from a really skewed distribution. There's some papers that get a huge amount of the citations. It's like the income distribution,
right?
Some people get a huge number of the citations, exactly, and then there's a lot of papers that hardly anyone ever looks at, and in some cases no one ever cites.
You talked about the Google H index, Google Scholar H index. Everybody checks. So I went and checked mine because I hadn't really even thought about it because I don't really do that kind of research anyway. Mine was 28. I don't know if that's any good or not.
That's pretty impressive. So that means you have 28 articles which have each been cited 28 times at least.
I see. But in a way, I don't want to be checking that because then I'm going to, try to do something maybe I don't actually want to do. So sort of like, a baseball player. Well, how do I be successful? Well, here are the metrics we use to judge you. Okay, then I'm going to go do those.
Right. rather than saying what you should be saying to yourself is, the reason that number, like it's like the letter versus the spirit of the law. The reason that number is there, the spirit of that number is that good research gets cited more, and so you want to do good research.
Right.
But instead, they're cutting out the good research bit, and they're just saying cited more. And so you see people doing massive self-citation, filling up their articles with references to all their previous work, which is, understandable to some extent because people build lines of research, and that's totally fine. Right. You've got to cite maybe five or six of your previous papers if you're building up a theory. It makes sense. But if you're citing, like, if 80% of the citations in your reference section are to yourself, maybe you're thinking more about your H index rather than.
You mentioned self-plagiarization, which is a weird concept.
Too. Yeah, yeah.
How can you plagiarize yourself? They're my words, my thoughts. Mm-hmm. Well, now that I'm older and I've written a lot, I find myself I'm about to write something. I say, I think I already wrote something about this, and I'll find it. And I'll think, okay, I got to rewrite this, but I really like the way I said it. So sometimes I just rewrite it. And sometimes I'll say, well, here's how I put it in 2003 in this book or whatever.
Right.
And I got that from Richard Dawkins because he's even older than me. He's written even more than me. And he's really good about this. He'll actually just indent the text of what he wrote back in such and such. And that's legitimate. But there was that case of I forget his name now, the science writer that got, he misquoted or made up quotes from Bob Dylan. And he got torpedoed.
Jonah Lehrer.
And he got when this came out that he was self-plagiarizing, I thought, well, what? Well, he was getting paid by one very popular journal to write something original, and he would just kind of recycle something from another big, because these are well-paying big name journals. You can't really get away with that. But if you're doing it in some obscure journal, probably no one would notice.
Well, no one notices until the problem is that until they do notice, and it's a bit like fraud where you find one article that's been self-plagiarized, and then you look at the rest of their work and you find, oh my God, this is all, patchwork of bits from previous papers. And again, it creates, aside from it being, dishonest in terms of the editor of the journal, you're telling them when you submit the paper that this is a new bit of writing or a new bit of research. apart from it being dishonest there, it creates a sort of, you know, it moves the playing fields to be, you know, to not be level anymore between different researchers. We're all comparing each other on the basis of our like citation counts and CVs and all that sort of stuff. Right. And there's someone with a massive CV, but it's because they self-plagiarized a huge amount. And there's, you know, I won't say the name, but there's a UK case now where it's a massively cited scientist who has endless papers, publishes probably a paper every single day, and sure enough, someone has discovered that there's vast amounts of what looks like self-plagiarism in that work, reusing the text over and over again from previous papers. You might ask, it's probably not as bad a thing as stealing other people's work, but it does always seem to be something that people do a huge amount of. And it's the same with fraud. Like, you discover that someone has photoshopped a picture, a microscope photo in one of their papers, and then, you know, there's empirical evidence for this, that, you know, you go into their other papers and you find it's been done loads of times there as well. People somehow can't resist it. It's like, it's a personality trait, like being dishonest, you know, it makes sense. Like, personality is a thing.
Yeah, the photograph examples you give in the book, that's just hard to believe that somebody would try to get away with it. That's pretty risky.
Yeah, it is. It's hiding in plain sight. You know, you have these, I mentioned a case that was in the 1960s where people had used the kind of rudimentary photo editing tools, you know, back then, and managed to get it into Science, an article. But nowadays it's so much easier to do it with Photoshop and so on. So one of the people to look up in this case is Elizabeth Bick, who is a microbiologist, and she's now, I think she now, her title is a scientific integrity consultant. So she does kind of investigations, just investigations of people's, of journals, you know, they look through journals and you look through the people's work and the photos. And she has this amazing eye for spotting one part of a photo that's identical to another part of a photo. And she does these kind of challenges on Twitter where she'll put up, you know, several different photos, which, you know, to you or I look like they're kind of random, you know, just pictures of cells or whatever it is, or blots. But she has, you know, and maybe later on she'll tweet another one showing that actually this part is identical to this part and this part is identical to this part.
Isn't there something like if you rotate the photograph upside down, it's hard to see that it's the same one as the other one that's right side up.
Yeah. So people, again, it's like fraudsters making data that doesn't look realistic. They can also make photos that don't look realistic, but fraudsters that are a bit wiser to it, that are the more kind of perfect crime type people, they're the smarter ones, that are less likely to get caught, are the ones that are thinking, oh, how do I make this picture look realistic? How do I make this data set look like it actually was, you know, it came from reality rather than my mind?
Right. Yeah. Well, I want to wrap things up here, Stuart. I know you're busy, but I love the example you provide in the book about Steve Gould, because I knew Steve. He was a good friend. And of course, I read his Mismeasure Man book and loved it. Mm-hmm. And all this stuff about bias in science that he called our attention to back in the late 70s and 80s was really important. But then, you know, the Morton skull thing that he wrote about, where Morton supposedly had this bias to show that black skulls were smaller than white skulls and so on, with Indians in between and whatnot. And then that kind of got debunked, but then the debunking got debunked. This was like 2011 and 2015. So it's fairly recent.
That's right.
And he's long gone to not be able to defend himself. But it shows you that how complicated it is, even with something relatively simple, like it's just a skull, fill it up with something. Well, what do you fill it up with? Because that may make a difference. And then how do you interpret it?
There was the lead shot versus the seeds. And then these days, actually, I think the technique hasn't changed that much these days. They use you know, little balls of silicone or whatever it is that kind of fill up the skull. That's the modern way of doing it.
Right.
The criticism of Gould has been criticized itself. And then there's four or five papers, all of which are discussed and cited in the book, that kind of go through all the reasons for it. My understanding is our current state, and this could change, is that Morton made some mistakes. But Gould exaggerated those mistakes, and also had his own biases. But the kind of meta point, if you want to actually, and you know, that's all very interesting for bias in science, and Gould was absolutely right that people are trying to make a clean story and all the stuff we've talked about already. He was talking about this stuff in the 1970s. You know, really, really, really great discussion of it. But the meta point is that if you actually want to understand reality, these are just samples of skulls that this guy had collected. They're not actually a representative sample of people from these places, right? Like, so you can't actually learn too much about the reality of if there are any skull differences from this. But it is instructive in a kind of meta-scientific sense about how, you know, you still, when someone comes up with this debunking of a scientific idea, you still got to check their debunking, and you've still got to be skeptical of the skeptics in that sense. And that's part of the whole scientific process, is being rigorously, you know, disinterested and skeptical all the time. And that's these kind of norms of science that I describe in the book, of being, of this process of organized skepticism constantly happening to everything and never stopping and saying that is the final answer.
Yeah. Well, when you put things like, you know, racial differences between these groups, racial differences in, say, intelligence or athletic ability or whatever, that's been supercharged since the 60s. You know, and then gender differences and cognitive abilities, that was, that got super controversial in the early 2000s. And now we're going through this like gender dysphoria and transsexual research. And these, you know, the studies are coming out like every week. It's like, ooh, what should we think? What should we think? And of course, people are divided on this, and the facts don't just speak for themselves. You really got to dig into how the study was actually done.
Yeah, yeah, and I think a lot of the reforms that I talked about, like things like pre-registration, being open with data, being transparent, and so on, can help to some extent take the heat out of these issues. I mean, obviously these are just hot button, massively controversial areas, but I think if people were much more open and transparent about how they go into doing their studies, and, you know, saying this is their hypothesis beforehand, and so on, I think you can make your studies more convincing. Basically, my message to scientists is there are simple things you can do that would make your studies look more convincing to people, rather than putting the study out there and then people can criticize it on the basis that you've not been transparent, that you may have come up with these analyses on the fly, that you're not sharing your data, that there's all these errors in your study. So I think some of the open science stuff can really be helpful here. Although, you know, it would be naive to suggest that it's going to solve any of these massive hot button issues.
Well, I often do wonder why scientists are interested in certain topics like that. Like, you know, why do you want to know if there are black-white differences in intelligence? This is so controversial, but why? Why do you want to know?
Exactly. And I think there is a kind of there's a glee that some scientists have when they discuss, they're not scientists necessarily, or some definitely have been some scientists in the past, but also lots of kind of activists online and who are jumping on this stuff, who are, you know, who, if there was a difference found, they would actually be pretty pleased, and they really like that idea. And so they talk about it in with this kind of really perverse kind of enjoyment almost. And you can instantly see that that's not the sort of person you should be relying on for data or any kind of, you know, dispassionate analysis.
Last year I went to this conference where this was part of the focus of the conference was, you know, group differences, both race and gender. And and the kind of underlying theme was, we are objective scientists and we're being unfairly attacked because we just want to present the facts as they are. And, you know, the woke left doesn't want to know these facts because their feelings trump the facts and so on. It's like, I don't know, you're pushing this a little too hard here.
Methinks
you're too interested in this subject. You're not just like an astronomer counting the number of stars in a slide or something like that.
Yeah, it becomes almost like a reactive thing. Like, I'm saying something because it's controversial, so I'll put it out there, and it'll exercise them in some way or make them upset almost in some way. And yeah, you can totally see that with all sorts of areas of research that are controversial, that people write papers knowing that they will get a response like that, and actually in some sense reveling in that, which is not dispassionate science disinterested science.
Boy, the libtards are going to explode when they see my study. Exactly. It's like, I don't know.
You get all the YouTube videos with like the capital letters in the title, this new study destroys the woke left or whatever happens to be. You know, it's like, that's not science either. You know, there's not such a thing as like the science and then the woke left on the other side. That's just not how it works. Right. We all need to be constantly thinking about our own biases.
Yeah, totally. Well, Stuart, thanks for coming on the show. Congratulations on the new book. Your book should be like assigned to every single undergraduate science student. You know, these are really core issues. So I don't know what it's going to take to get it out there. Where would you direct people to go online to read more about this besides your book? This open science project.
Yeah, if you look up open science, and there are websites like the Center for Open Science, which is works out of the University of Virginia. They have loads of resources on their website of how to, you know, essentially change science. They have a blog that updates on all the kind of new things that they're doing. Their big focus is on, you know, trying to make it easy for scientists to do this stuff. So there are lots of tools that are freely available on there. And, you know, on that website, there are also loads of people's data and loads of people's, you know, experimental plans and stuff. So you can see how it should look. But also, I mean, I think one of the big places for this discussion on open science has been Twitter, has been social media, has been following people who are, you know, not only the people who are discovering the major problems in people's research, which also sometimes happens on Twitter. Sometimes someone will like put a thread saying, I think there might be something really weird about this data set, and you can watch that happen. But also people saying, I've got a new tool. This is a really good way to annotate your code, or this is a really good way to share your data with other people. This is a really good new idea that a journal could use to make its research more reliable. So I think just following this general open science discussion on Twitter is a great thing, and can kind of open your mind to, okay, it's not just that we just accept what's in the journals. We need to constantly be questioning that.
What's your Twitter handle? Social
media. I'm Stuart J. Ritchie on Twitter, just all one word, Stuart.
All right. And you're not directing people to send Bitcoins anywhere?
I don't have a blue tick, so I wasn't hacked.
I see. That's too funny. Yeah, very good. And so what's the next big project for you?
Well, I think now that this book is done, I want to focus on doing more like standard scientific stuff, which is, you know, my interest is in cognitive abilities, kind of cognitive aging, and I'm in a kind of psychiatry center now at King's College London. So I want to kind of work more on the intersection of cognitive processes and mental health. So that's my kind of where I'm kind of aiming for. But I want to do it in this open way. I want to make sure that everything is being pre-registered, data is being shared, code's being shared as much as possible. So I'm going to try and model good research practice for this area. That's good. My plan.
You got to figure out this cognitive decline thing, because I'm 65 now. So you got 15 years to figure it out before we baby boomers hit the wall.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Okay. I better get back to that.
All right, Stuart. Thanks again. I love the book. To you. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye.